If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
People of the US, great news. The Formula One Circus is coming to Miami this weekend, and we've got everything you need to know on P1 with Matt and Tommy, the Formula One podcast from Stack. It doesn't matter if you're an F1 veteran or hardly watch a race. If you want a fun breakdown of the biggest stories from this weekend's race, we've got you covered. Join us for previews and reaction episodes from practice, qualifying, and the race itself, plus our full driver rankings podcast early next week. You'll be armed with enough info to make you look like a bona fide expert when the race rolls back around next year, or at least when you see your friends next week. Search P1 with Matt and Tommy in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now.
Do you want to give a special shout-out, Andy and James, Andy or James, to Ukraine and Poland for qualifying for the Euros?
You mean Sheva?
Sheva's Ukraine.
Mm, yeah.
Let's hear it. Let's hear it for the boys. Let's give the boys a hand.
It's pretty impressive, although Portugal don't like easy ways of qualifying for major tournaments. That much is pretty clear, and the same was clear again when they played in Kiev this week, because they didn't defend well. They had the better of the game and should have come away with at least a point, but they didn't. And Piatov rolled back the years with his performance in goal and made a couple of really good saves, especially from Cristiano Ronaldo.
Yarmolenko's been in good form.
He has, which definitely helps.
Most devastating one-footed player in world football at the moment, would you say?
Well, now Arjen Robben's packed it in.
Yeah.
It's an interesting point.
Yeah.
Definitely. But I think when you think about, like, I guess a lot of people's thoughts, certainly in this country, of the current generation of Ukrainian footballers, is that sort of wing twins business of Yarmolenko and Konoplyanka. And that Konoplyanka's gone back to Ukraine, has gone back to Shakhtar, and you would imagine will grow in strength throughout the season, is something that I think augurs pretty well for them for next year. But Shevchenko's done an incredible job to get them top of this group and winning this group, and that's going to matter in terms of seeding as well. So it's really an incredible achievement by them.
But you look at the team that won the under 20 World Cup in the summer. That feels like a long time ago now. And also, one of the players that's really impressed me since he's come to Serie A this season is Malinovsky, who Atalanta signed. He is a really technically gifted central midfield player who can either play as a number 8 or a number 10, and has allowed them to kind of rotate Papu Gomez or Josip Iličić, which isn't easy because there are not many players like them around in terms of, you know, players you can play the ball into feet in the final third, can hold it up, can beat players, can pick a final pass, good distribution, whether it be, you know, sort of crossing for a far post, you know, those kind of slide rule curlers in behind that's so difficult to defend. He's a real talent, and I'll definitely look out for him. Touch wood, he stays fit come the summer, because I think he's probably still flying a little bit under radar, even though he's a part of a team that won the league in Belgium last year and was very much at the heart of that side.
I don't think, he's hardly a household name. I mean, I think he is under the radar for sure. And in a group where Portugal and Serbia are also in their group B, I mean, they've done really well. And another team who've done brilliantly is Poland as well. I mean, Lewandowski's, what, 5 goals for them? I mean, the question marks around Lewandowski will obviously be when it comes to the tournament itself. It'll be in people's minds still, I'm sure, he's kind of flat to deceive in the World Cup in 2018. But they've been decent in this qualification cycle, and they've qualified with a bit of room to spare as well.
Yeah, they have, and it feels like he's central again. As you say, we don't really know how it will pan out until you actually get to the final stages of a tournament, because that's where he's been criticised, and it's been the same in the final stage of the Champions League in the last little while as well. But I remember being in a press conference in France at Euro 2016 after that last 16 game where they won on penalties against Switzerland, and Lewandowski had struggled up until that point. He didn't actually score in the tournament until the next game, which was a quarter against Portugal in Marseille. And I remember Adam Nawalka, the coach at the time, who's no longer there, of course, sitting there and being asked about the fact that not only was Lewandowski not scoring, he wasn't really getting opportunities. And he was saying, well, you know, Robert's a great guy. He's not a normal superstar. He's happy to muck in and help the lads and all the rest of it. And I'm like, well, I'm all for work ethic, but why are you not creating a platform? Why are your tactics not creating a platform for your undeniably world-class player to do his stuff?
And they had a fairly good team around that time, right? Was it just before that with their Kuba and all the rest of it?
Sure, but
Piszczek and stuff.
Yeah, but I mean, should they have ever been in a position where the team was built to feed Milik instead of Lewandowski? No. I like Arkadiusz Milik a lot, but no, you know, it should have always been all about Lewandowski, and that was the issue. If they've found a way to get around that, then that's great. I do think there are questions about the team elsewhere. I mean, it's one of those things about internationals. If you've got a glut of top class goalkeepers, and you know, Slovenia have been there before when they had Oblak and Handanovic at the same time. What can you do with the other one? You can't fit him in the team. You know, that's just one of those things. But I do think, you know, you look at players like Pazdan, even Kamil Glik, have really gone backwards in the last couple of years. And that would concern me going forward.
Also, I mean, you can say this about a lot of the groups in the qualifiers, but I would have expected, you know, Poland to get through a group with Macedonia, Austria, Slovenia, Israel, Latvia.
Yeah, they've had a nice group. But
I think the thing to add here is that on the one hand, it felt that their cycle was coming to an end a couple of years ago, and it looks like they're capable of going again. Andy mentioned the glut of goalkeepers that they've got. And, you know, in terms of strength and depth there, you know, with Szczesny, Fabianski, Skorupski, Dragowski, I mean, it's pretty impressive. And then, you know, Lewandowski is having to still be the guy, because, you know, the guys that Andy mentioned again, you know, sort of Milik and Piontek as well, have not had a very good start to the season at all, whereas Lewandowski seems to have once again kind of confirmed that he is, I think at this moment in time, the best centre forward in the world.
I think
without a doubt.
The other thing about Lewandowski to note as he's getting into his 30s is something I spoke about with Clive Allen actually in forthcoming Ramble Meets. He was saying he thinks Lewandowski has almost retreated back from doing more all-round work. You know, you think of that player he was for Dortmund, and that's why he was so impossible to replace when he went, because he was a player who, like Cristiano
Ronaldo...
You're
saying that Ciro Immobile and Adrian Ramos could not replace Robert Lewandowski.
Well, I couldn't replace one player between them, let alone four.
Yeah.
But, you know, he performed so many different functions, you were never going to be able to replace him with one player. And that's where Dortmund were at. They realised that, didn't they? And they tried to get two to replace him, and it still didn't work. But now, Lewandowski is simply focused on scoring goals. That's it. And, you know, some people would see that as a weakness, but, you know, it's proven to be a strength for him.
I'd like him to have a big tournament because I think he's obviously the standout Polish goal scorer in history, yeah. Despite them having that amazing era in the kind of 70s.
And 82 when they reached the
early
semi-final.
80s. Yeah, yeah. So it'd be great for him to have that to kind of cap off what's been a fantastic career. And special note for Russia as well, they've also qualified. I mean, it's interesting to me that we're going into World Cup 2018 with apparently them being the worst host nation for in living memory, yet they did okay.
But quite a few teams say that before they're about to host or co-host the tournament. You know,
but I think
there,
everyone was kind of saying
that. What's going to happen in Austria, this Euros? Because everyone's hosting it.
Exactly.
So is everyone going to be the favourite?
We might see some of the worst football ever.
Yeah, so I mean, we've done away with that cliche of you want to see the hosts do well, don't you?
Well, if England get to the semis, it's on because the semis and the final are at Wembley, as you guys know. Andy, how might these Catalonia protests affect La Liga? There's talk of the Clásico being moved from the Nou Camp. 9 separatists have been jailed by the Spanish authorities, causing widespread protests that have caused Barcelona to change their travel plans ahead of the game against Eibar. What's the latest there? How do you see this one?
Well, La Liga have asked the RFEF, the Spanish Federation, to switch the game from Barcelona to Madrid.
So they're not saying, well, we think it should be moved to a neutral territory. They're saying move it to Madrid.
No, but they're talking about swapping the fixtures. So Barcelona would get there later in the season. It's not like they're having a giveaway home fixture.
Does it tell you everything you need to know about Madrid that I thought they were just saying, no, we'll play both games in Madrid, thanks? You could definitely see them saying that.
It'd be amusing if they were going to say, we're not going to play at the Bernabeu. We're going to play it at Getafe or like at Rayo Vallecano.
Yeah.
You know, or the obvious choice after last year's Copa Libertadores, El Monumental.
Yeah, playing Buenos Aires.
Yeah, just for security reasons, so you understand.
But this does strike to the core of what Barcelona have traditionally been and what they've strived to become, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does, because I think it's easy to forget nowadays, because they're such a global phenomenon, that this is historically an intensely political club and a club that is an overtly political symbol. And, you know, it's very hard to separate them from that. And, you know, we go back a couple of years ago when they had the protests after the Spanish in Catalonia and especially in Barcelona, where the Spanish government rejected the legitimacy of the Catalan independency referendum. And they asked for it to be postponed, their match against Las Palmas in, I think it was October 2017.
Yeah.
The league and the RFEF said no, so they played it behind closed doors.
With no fans, yeah, I remember.
Now, I remember at the time, like, seeing a lot of news pieces done by like the BBC and CNN and various other international news organisations, and, you know, there were people outside the ground who were crestfallen saying, I've come from Australia, or I've come from India, or I've come from the States to see Barcelona and they're shutting us out. But I think that's a little reminder of the fact that perhaps globally people don't really understand what Barcelona mean historically, or at least they've forgotten what Barcelona mean historically. And it's, you know, very difficult to separate a sense of being Catalan from Barcelona. So it is something that affects the club and affects the city. Obviously, from a Madrid perspective, they think their security is threatened in terms of El Clásico. But it makes it very, very difficult for Barcelona, because what it would mean if they inverted the fixtures and they end up playing this game in Madrid instead of at home at Camp Nou, it means it's the third away fixture in a row in a week, after Eibar, as you said, Slavia Prague in the Champions League, and then leading up to El Clásico at the Bernabeu. That's hard work. And I don't care if people look at it and say, oh, well, Eibar and Slavia Prague, they're not the most two difficult fixtures in the world. Well, Eibar will be difficult enough, and Slavia Prague involves some travelling, obviously, and it is a Champions League fixture. And you've got to factor in the fact that Barcelona have been terrible on the road for a long time now. I mean, they've won one away game all season at Getafe, which was tough and felt to an extent like a turning point, but still they're at the beginning of turning things around. So this is something that could really affect them from a footballing sense could really affect their season.
Is that the most likely outcome, do you think, by the way?
Yeah, I think it is.
Right.
And it could really affect the outcome of La Liga as well. You look at Zinedine Zidane's been very, very clear since the end of last season that La Liga is the priority above and beyond the Champions League. It's something we talked about on here before. I know they're only 2 points in front at the moment, Madrid, but the fact, if they were to get El Clasico at theirs at this point in the season, I think that's quite a big advantage. It's not to say that Barcelona are incapable of winning there.
But is there some suggestion that...
It does mean that it would be weighted a little in Madrid's favour.
Is there some suggestion that this is being seen as opportunistic from Real Madrid trying to make the best of what is quite a volatile and febrile situation?
Oh, clearly. The Catalan press and...
well, I know the Catalan press are going to say that.
A lot of people around Barcelona feel that. Right. Absolutely.
And is this something that's likely to continue long-term, these protests? Because we're seeing protests erupt all over the world for lots of different reasons. And some of them have been quite long-standing. So
as we've said, you know, this is an issue going back...
a long time,
a couple of years now, you know, that, and it has already disrupted the football calendar, but I think it's kind of a bit of a recalibration and a sort of redrawing of to all of us and to the football world of what Barcelona are really about, because they've been so global, and that's something that they've actively courted and they've actively aimed to do. And I think a lot of hardcore Barcelona fans have, you know, been upset by this. They've been upset by the Qatar links. They've been upset by the running of the club, and they've been upset by what they see as moving away from
the core values
of the club. But the fact is, at a point like this, when it's so all-consuming, and when it's such a public deal, and when you have Xavi and Gerard Piquet talking out about it on social media and in the press, it's something that's completely unavoidable.
Interesting.
Is it not also problematic that they're ultimately going to make a decision on this 3 days before the game?
Yeah, I mean, again, it's something that, you know, obviously I have a great deal of sympathy for people people all over the world, not just people within Spain, who will have not just bought tickets, but bought flights, bought hotels, and will be just left high and dry at a moment's notice. I do think this is something that Spanish football is very bad about anyway. I mean, we know they're very bad at setting times and dates on the calendar. Broadly speaking, over the last couple of years, it's something that they've not done very well, and they've done with very short notice, with very little thought to the fans that are going to come to the game. I know La Liga have tried to make steps forward in terms of planning fixtures further in advance, and I think that's a nod towards the fact that there is a more international audience. I don't just mean in terms of television, but in terms of people actually coming to the games, and that's something that they've still got to work on. I guess they'd say in a situation like this, it's unforeseen, it's unexpected, the veracity of the protests, and it's something that's completely unavoidable. Giannini, Donadoni, och bra skott, och retur, och Chiracchi och mål!
People of the US, great news. The Formula One Circus is coming to Miami this weekend, and we've got everything you need to know on P1 with Matt and Tommy, the Formula One podcast from Stack. It doesn't matter if you're an F1 veteran or hardly watch a race. If you want a fun breakdown of the biggest stories from this weekend's race, we've got you covered. Join us for previews and reaction episodes from practice, qualifying, and the race itself, plus our full driver rankings podcast early next week. You'll be armed with enough info to make you look like a bona fide expert when the race rolls back around next year, or at least when you see your friends next week. Search P1 with Matt and Tommy in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now.
Batte lo spagnolo, cerca Koulibaly! Kalidou Koulibaly al 90th, segna per il Napoli.
James, a lot of excitement coming out of
I'm going to say the internet, about a report or an article in Tutto Sport linking quite strongly Max Allegri to the Manchester United job. I think it's something that's been suspected for some time. Talk of Allegri learning English, talk of him only sort of cancelling his sabbatical for a genuinely big job, talk of Man United being one of the worst football teams in the world on the pitch at the moment, despite spending £47 billion a season on players. Something that's probably going to get a bit worse after they lose to Liverpool this weekend. Can you, a lot of the people have emailed in otc@footballroundwithdaily.com, and a lot of the questions are, can you please ask James how real this is? What's the veracity of this reporting? Is there anything we should know about? What's moved?
The report is written by Guido Vacciago, who I think is Tutto Sport's most authoritative writer. So I think it's to be taken seriously. From my end,
give us a little preview of what the article actually said for those who haven't seen it.
So the article says that there is contact between United and Allegri. Yeah, just to speculate, I mean, that would not be a surprise given the situation that United find themselves in.
Yeah.
17 points from their last 17 games. They've got this game coming up against Liverpool at the weekend. I think even though the brief from United is that Solskjaer is in no jeopardy, there's a level of incredulity about that because of where United are at.
And the fact that they're obviously on manoeuvres. Everyone knows they're on manoeuvres behind the scenes.
Well, and the thing is, Allegri, I think, would like to work in England. I think that has been an ambition of his for some time. Even when he was fired by Milan, it was something that he was taking into consideration to come and work over here. There are two jobs that look like, I wouldn't say... there are ones that are being scrutinised by the media, and that's United and the one at Spurs as well. And Allegri was at, I think he was at the Bayern game as a guest of, I think, Franco Baldini, who sat with Patrice Evra, watching that.
Hashtag squad goals?
Well, no. I mean, from what I can gather, Allegri would like to go to United, just as a lot of other high-profile coaches would like to go to that club because of the history and tradition of it, and to be the guy who turns that club around.
Is there any concern about the infrastructure, though? Any concern about what's happening off the pitch and what their kind of direction is?
Undoubtedly, but I think there's if you look at United quite crudely, you can see in that club A, the potential, and B, the fact that they are very, very wealthy.
Yeah.
And that if you are listened to and you have clear ideas as to what you think the squad needs, then you can go about changing that. And also, I think something has to be said about United is that having a manager who elite players want to play for and look at, when they see United and think, oh, yeah, they've got a manager there who can win things.
Yeah.
I'm not necessarily sure that is the perception that they have at this moment in time with Ole Gunnar Solskjaer as the manager. Unless you grew up as a United fan, I think his track record does not point to someone who is a serial winner of trophies in elite leagues.
I said at the time they might as well have hired Clive Tilsley. They've essentially hired the commentary of the 1999 Champions League final to manage Man United. That's what's happened.
I mean, to again give you some info on Allegri is still currently being paid by Juventus. But he was fired, and it's ultimately, as we've spoken about on this pod before, coaches will remain on the books of a club until they find a new club. And I think with Juventus as well, there was a degree of goodwill towards Allegri after everything that he had achieved with the club. And so...
You and I were talking about this week, actually, weren't we, James? The fact that it's very easy to forget with Schalke putting out that tweet this week about Domenico Tedesco, saying Domenico Tedesco has now come to an agreement for the end of his contract with Schalke, and we wish him all the best at Spartak Moscow. And you think, okay.
Yeah, because he's still being paid.
Yeah.
I'm still on the payroll.
Yeah. And And again, something with Allegri is that he's kind of studied English on and off since he was at Cagliari. And I've been at press conferences with him. Let's say, you know, the ones where Juventus have played Spurs or an English side in the Champions League, City. Mm. And, you know, when he's been asked questions in English, he hasn't needed the interpreter sat next to him to translate the question, only his answer. He has understood what he's been asked. I still think speaking English would be a problem. Also, from Juventus' point of view, I think they just published their accounts, and, you know, Allegri and his staff cost them kind of €60 million gross over the year. So that's a big expense.
They want to get rid of it.
To be paying.
Wow.
Well, I mean, it's not unusual for a top club to have a manager. I mean, you look at Diego Simeone, what he gets paid, and that is after tax.
But crucially, Diego Simeone is still managing the club.
Yes.
That's the crucial difference.
But as we've ascertained on this, this isn't unusual.
No.
So do you expect him to expect United just to go out and say, We're working in this way, so what we need to do is get the best manager we can get who's currently available to get the most out of this team, and it's really as simple as that, and Allegri is the one they want.
Yeah, and also I think, you know, what would be quite unusual about, say, urgent intervention is that surely if you're going to get rid of the manager, you should be doing it, you know, prior to an international break.
Why is that the conceived wisdom, though? Why is that the kind of
accepted because ultimately
wisdom?
You may get, and I say may, conditional 10 or 14 days to work with the players. The reason I use the conditional is because when you're manager of a club like United,
they're all off an international duty.
They're all off an international duty anyway.
The thing I find interesting, I don't want to get this into a proper English-based chat because we'll do that tomorrow on the preview show, but they play Liverpool at home this weekend.
Easy game.
A lot of attention is made of that, but the thing is, it's not. I don't think that's the key game.
You don't think they'll be judged? Everyone
knows Liverpool brilliant, and I actually think Man United. I mean, they got a draw against Arsenal, didn't they? They can kind of get themselves up for those type of games. They got away to Norwich and away to Bournemouth after that. They're the two killer games.
Yeah,
they're the games where he'll come unstuck if he's going to come unstuck.
Also, I do think I have the impression that United are quite sensitive to the intensity of the media glare when it comes to. I mean, you can imagine after a defeat to Liverpool, depending on the margin of that defeat, there will be a lot of pressure.
Oh, if they get whipped 6-0, it's a different story. Yeah. It's a different story. We'll watch it for interest. But one manager, James, just to change tack ever so slightly, who has taken the job is everyone's best friend, Claudio Ranieri. He's taken over.
Yeah, he's been ruled out of the United job.
yeah, exactly. To return the glory days to Man United.
Allegri must be rubbing his hands thinking, I've got more of a chance now. Yeah. Claudio's gone.
He's gone to the worst team in Serie A. Is that fair? On paper, at least.
Well, in terms of the table at the moment, yes.
Certainly
on paper,
start.
No. Hmm. But you're absolutely right, Luke. 6 defeats in 7 games.
I meant on paper, if the specific piece of paper was the league table.
Yes.
Then it's absolutely on paper.
Okay, well, then you're spot on.
Yeah.
Claudio has come in.
Playing Roma in the first game, interestingly.
Yeah, although there are some doubts as to whether that game will be played because it's anticipated that there will be some pretty heavy rainstorms and bad weather.
Right.
And unfortunately, we've seen that city and that part of Italy have experience of bad flooding and games, particularly the Ferraris, be called off because pitch doesn't drain. It's just a bit of a nightmare, really. So there's some doubts around that. But no, Ranieri comes in. He has been pretty clear that his job is to save Sampdoria from relegation. They don't want to let this situation continue any further, let it drift. And I think one of the things that he has to first sort out is he has to make them hard to beat, which is something that he did with Roma when he came in for Di Francesco again last year. He's replacing Di Francesco once more.
What's happened to Di Francesco?
And Claudio is like, oh god, I hope he doesn't hate me for just keeping coming in and just sort of I suppose clearing up Eusebio's mess. But he'll teach them the ABCs of football. You can pretty much guarantee that they'll start this game against Roma if it goes ahead playing 4-4-2. He needs to help. He needs to stop them conceding goals. Needs to impose some kind of discipline because you've got penalties being given away. You've got Murillo, who's a liability, getting sent off whenever he's eligible to play. You have a team that, as soon as it goes behind, the heads go down and they collapse. They completely collapse. They can see 2, 3, 4 goals in the space of 10-15 minutes and the game's gone. And he needs to get Quagliarella scoring again. Yeah, let's not forget Quagliarella is the reigning capocannoniere in Serie A, and he scored, I think, once this season, which was against
Sassuolo. Is it a season too far for him, though?
For Quagliarella?
Yeah, is that why?
I think Quagliarella's still got something to give as long as the team plays to his strengths, which it never was under Di Francesco. Mm. Under Di Francesco, they wanted a 36, 37-year-old to press from the front and run like a madman, which, you know, with all the will in the world... And all the, you know, sort of, despite Quagliarella knowing his own body, knowing what's best, you know, that is going to be a tall order for any player of that age to play with the intensity that Di Francesco expects and expected of his Samp players. So, you know, I think ultimately one of the reasons why Samp are in this position, it's not entirely down to Di Francesco. He did try and shake things up. He tried to change how the team played, the system, but he was undermined by the fact that the club has been in a takeover talks for a hell of a long time. It dragged on and dragged on, which impacted the business that they did in the summer, limited the business that they did in the summer. And I think rather than distracting the players, it certainly meant that Di Francesco didn't get the kind of players that he wanted to come in so he could actually execute kind of style of football that he wanted to play, because Samp were a team that played 4-4-2 diamond, no wingers under Gianpaolo, and Di Francesco plays 4-3-3 or 3-4-3. He wants width, he wants wingers, and there's simply no width, no wingers in that team unless you convert your fullbacks to wingbacks. So,
I mean, James, how much is there parallels with the Sampdoria connection with, say, Marco Gianpaolo going to Milan and not really having the players that he needed for his system? I mean, is that the coach's fault in not adapting to the players, or is it the club's fault in not providing those players? And the other question I wanted to ask with Sam is, how much of their problem has been losing two of their best players in Joachim Andersson and Dennis Pryor, not really replacing them?
Yeah, I think they've got an issue in that Murillo, one more experienced than Joachim Andersson, is just not as good a player. Mm. Even though he's played at Inter, Valencia and Barcelona, there's a reason why he keeps hop-skipping.
Well, Andersson can really pass it, can't he?
Yeah, precisely. And they don't have any kind of invention in midfield without Dennis Pret. They've got some honest, athletic players who've got good potential, you know, be it Linetti, be it Vieira. But they don't really have anyone certainly playing the way that Di Francesco wanted to play, who can pick a pass and break the lines in the way that Pret could. But to go back to what you were saying about managers unable to adapt, yeah, this has always struck me as something with, you know, Italian owners, sporting directors. Yeah, when you appoint a manager, you look at their track record, you know that they play a style of one particular style of football, and they always have. Particularly if you've got enough kind of a sample size to say, actually, at Roma and at Sassuolo and, you know, these other clubs, Di Francesco always played this way. Same with Milan. The brief from Milan has been that they were surprised how narrow-minded Gianpaolo was about, you know, the system that he wanted to play. It's like, well, hang on a minute. If you'd watched anything from his Samp days, from his Empoli days, you knew that he plays 4-4-2 diamond and he doesn't really deviate from that.
Mm. But isn't there a tradition in Italy that the coach just coaches the players?
Yeah.
So the hierarchy are forgiven for saying, you know the players you've got to work with, can you work with them?
Precisely.
And someone like Gianpaolo thought, well, it's Milan, so I'm going to go there.
Yeah.
And then it's not been compatible. So to answer Andy's original question, sure, it's a bit of both. It's the coach being too dogmatic, but it's the hierarchy making the appointment in the first place and not matching the coach with the players, right?
Well, part of it's fate and luck as well, isn't it? Because, you know, we talked about how whole transfer chains can collapse in the summer. Mm. At the moment when Lyon decided that they weren't buying Suso from Milan and they were going to buy Geoffrey and Adelaide instead from Angers, that made the whole chain collapse, where they were stuck with Suso, who's a terrific player, but not really what Gianpaolo wanted. They couldn't get Correa from Atletico Madrid. And that's not something that either the club or the coach could do something about, is it?
No, but it looks like Souza will probably be on the market again come the summer, because I think yesterday it was reported that Milan in their accounts, 143 million in the red. Oof. So even though they've renegotiated their agreement with UEFA over financial fair play, that is a major obstacle to overcome. And you know, come January, they may be compelled to put Souza on the market again. The problem is that Souza likely doesn't have the value that he did in the summer, because you know, his performances, you know, in my opinion, certainly for the last 9 months, have not really justified the kind of feeling within Milan that he's a really important player to
them. He was standout at the time. I remember a year or so ago when we were talking about him, he was like Milan's best player, wasn't he?
No, without doubt.
Andy, Leon have made their move, gone after Roma legend Rudy Garcia. What do you make of that?
Well, there are a lot of very unhappy Leon fans out there.
I can imagine. That's
for sure. A lot of them digging through Google Images to pick out that shot of him posing happily as a Saint-Étienne assistant. Mm. You know, they can't get enough for each other, Saint-Étienne and Leon, at the moment, can they? After what you guys were talking about on last week's show, of course. And
it's kind of superhero, supervillain. They need each other to have sort of relevancy.
But really, it's less about the fact that he was assistant coach of Saint-Étienne, and more about the fact, not even that he was coach of Marseille in his last job, but in how he behaved and how he interacted with Leon while he was coach of Marseille. And the fact that...
Because they're rivals as well, Marseille and Lyon, right? So it's not just a Lyon Saint-Étienne thing.
They
he was most recently seen at Marseille, who are also big rivals of Lyon.
Yeah, and it's not just that. Like I say, it's the way that Garcia interacted with Lyon, with them as a team, with Jean-Michel Aulas, the president. And neither Aulas or Juninho looked as if they were exactly letting off the party poppers at the introductory press conference. obviously, part of that is because Juninho is having to eat some humble pie after what happened to Silvinho. But Rudy Garcia had said previous gems from when he was in charge of Marseille include Leon would struggle to be in the top five if VAR existed when they were battling it out for a Champions League place with Marseille.
So he wears his heart on his sleeve then.
Garcia's defence, which I think was a fairly reasonable one, his introductory press conference earlier this week was, well, when I'm in charge of a club, I defend them to the hilt.
Mm.
And I suppose that's quite hard to argue with in a sense. But at the moment, Leon fans are not happy at all. And that means he's got a lot of work already to do to turn it around. Now, where I think he does turn it around, or where I think at least there's the potential to turn it around, is what Juninho said and, you know, how the mighty have fallen in terms of the grand ambitions they had at the start of the season. Is Juninho was saying at some length in that press conference, we've lost the base that Bruno Genesio built us. And again, that's not a great way to sell it to the fans, because the fans have been saying for the last couple of years, Genesio's not a guy who's big enough for this club. Yeah, we understand he's a guy who has Leon in his heart, but you know, he's someone who's just there because he's chums with the academy players, and you know, he can't get the players to perform consistently each week. We saw Genesio could get them to perform in some very big games last season, but he couldn't get them to do it.
He delivered them Champions League football though, right?
Yeah, but one would say that's the bare minimum with the second best set of players in France.
They don't like the second best set of players in France at the moment.
Well, no, they don't, and that's the whole problem.
Yeah.
In terms of budget, in terms of the players they've got, you know, they should be up there at least hanging on to the coattails of Paris Saint-Germain. But I think it was really interesting to hear Juninho expand and say, the thing is, whatever you say about Genesio, the football was attacking. It was exciting. And that's absolutely right. He did make the most of those attacking players. Now, the whole problem with Silvinho was not just the fact that he couldn't make his mind up on a tactical system, but when they went into big games like against Paris Saint-Germain, the like against Saint-Étienne, both of which they didn't score in and both of which they lost to late goals, is the fact that they didn't even play with three at the back, they played with five at the back, having signed off with Juninho that they were going to play 4-3-3 at the start of the season, because there was always the sense, and I think that weakened Silvinho significantly, the fact that it was really Juninho's team and he was just he was, Silvino was just the name above the door.
But that's certainly the joke you guys were consistently making the entire time he was in situ, guys. So you have contributed to this, undermining him, mocking him at every turn.
I feel proud.
You got what you wanted.
But the fact that they were playing with five in the back at those massive games, and you know they weren't seeking to be proactive, was something that negatively affected the perception by the supporters and negatively affected the perception by everyone at the club. That's where Garcia can change things, I think, because he has, whatever you think about him, he's someone who has a really firm philosophy as a coach.
And the, you know, Brendan of Liga.
There we go.
I would have loved it. I would have loved it.
That's a compliment.
Do you know what? Because this would have been fantastic. Sadly, it didn't quite come to pass, but you're talking about Garcia's comments when he was coaching Marseille.
Yeah.
And of course, they Leon probably not only sort of thought what you just said there, Andy, but also thought, well, this is a guy that took Marseille to the Europa League final, you know. And they were outclassed. Badly.
Won the league with Lille?
Yeah, quite.
Yeah, double.
But the great thing about the Europa League final is it was at Lyon. And he could have come into the press conference and said, I'm the last person to win a trophy here for Marseille. That would have been amazing.
He wasn't able to.
No, he wasn't. They got outclassed in the final. They got whooped. Was it 3-0?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But there's a huge class gap between those two teams. Mm.
Rudy is...
I've done brilliantly to get to the final. I did.
Rudy is a very charismatic guy. In terms of like pushing buttons, I remember when he was at Roma, some of the things he said, yeah, they really kind of whipped up the kind of fan base and got them all behind him. And I don't think really anyone's done that since Roma. And he is someone who presents and interviews very well. And again, I think we talked this time last week that Laurent Blanc was the favourite for the job. I think Juninho had put him forward.
Wenger was in the mix as well, apparently.
Disappointed in how he interviewed, and this was kind of the similar thing with when Garcia got the Roma job, because Blanc went in before him to talk to the club, and then didn't get it. And I think Garcia tells his story in his book, which was that Garcia basically sent a text to his agent saying that, you know, Roma's sporting director at the time, Walter Sabatini, preferred to, you know, after 15 minutes, left Blanc's interview to go and have a cigarette. And to be honest, Sabatini can't go 5 minutes without a cigarette. Right. So that doesn't necessarily mean anything.
It's from the
Sarri
school of cigarette. It's a compliment, really.
But Garcia basically won that job as being a complete outsider because, I make the Brendan comparison kind of, yeah, quite favourably, really, because he goes in there with a huge dossier. Like, this is what I know about your club. This is the project I have for your club. I'm completely aware of the situation. This is how we are going to change things. And it's a very good sell. It's a very good pitch.
In a sentence, how do Roma see Garcia's reign there? Very briefly.
First season was incredible. Yeah. I mean, you know, everyone has this idea that Juventus have been completely unchallenged for 8 years. But the truth is that they were challenged by first Allegri's Milan with Ibrahimovic and Thiago Silva, then by surprise by Garcia's Roma, who won their first 10 games.
Yeah.
10 or 11 games.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons why, you know, when we judge Conte and his record in the Champions League, they went out in the group stage that year primarily because they're like, Jesus.
Yeah, we've got to focus on the league.
We've got to focus on the league here because Roma are running away with this.
I think it's hard to get away from the fact that he's not a household name or whatever, certainly not in this country, that Rudy Garcia is. He's an excellent coach.
Yeah. I agree.
Did they win the double? Did he win the double at Lille?
Double with Lille for the first time since the 50s.
And he could essentially have his pick of the job.
Yeah.
His pick of the jobs. He eventually goes to Roma. His win percentage at Roma was higher than his win percentage at Lille. Yeah. So he did a decent enough job there as well. So it's an exciting appointment for them.
Yeah, yeah. All I would say is the biggest possible compliment you can pay to Roma under Rudy Garcia is the fact that there's that story, isn't there, that at one Oktoberfest with the right time of the year, Pep Guardiola, after a couple of drinks, goes, hey, Juventus are playing Roma tonight, let's all get a private plane over there and go and see the game, come on.
What a keno. Absolute keno.
But the thing is, I was talking about the kind of charisma that Garcia has. Like, some of the things that he said at the time have become, have entered the lexicon of Italian football, like putting the church back in the centre of the village. All this sort
That's
of thing.
Nice. That is nice.
He has a real way of wayward words, which, you know, ultimately is one of the reasons why there's so much resistance to his appointment at Lyon.
Yeah, but I mean, you know what football fans are like, and I don't profess to know the ins and outs of the exact rivalry between those two teams. He wins a few games up his belt. They go up the table.
If they win with style, yeah, I think that's
fine.
That's big.
You know, look what happened. You know, when Alex McLeish went across the divide in Birmingham. You know, it can happen. It's still very, very popular there. Yeah, but you know, Garcia, you know, Europa League final with Marseille, double with Lille, good reputation and good win percentage at Roma. I think it's an exciting appointment. I'm surprised that, with respect to the teams he has coached, I'm surprised Garcia has not gone on to bigger and better things even than that. Maybe he will.
Well, if he turns it around at Lyon, it's a huge feather in his cap.
Neymar's out, injured again.
He can manage Neymar full-time. That's a full-time job.
This is what I'm saying, is you've got, you know, Neymar, Mbappe and Cavani. They haven't played together this season.
They haven't played together for 9 months.
It's on.
Yeah, Lyon are already 12 points behind them.
Andy's already booking his flights to Lyon in May to go and celebrate the league title.
Yeah, Lyon are only 12 points behind them after nine games. What could go wrong? Quick note for the legend that is Bastian Schweinsteiger. Should we mention him? I feel like we shouldn't let the episode go past without talking about his career, maybe even if it's just briefly, after he announced his retirement at the age of, I think, 35. Amazing player down the years.
Yeah, he really was. And I think the biggest compliment you can pay to him is he was a tremendous player in two different positions. Hmm. And, you know, you think of...
I thought you were going to say for two different clubs then. Bayern and Manchester United.
Chicago Fire. Okay. Yeah. I think, like, when you think how good he was as a winger in his early years on either side... And then obviously, say you compare him to, like, I don't know, David Beckham, and Beckham always felt that he needed to establish himself in central midfield to be taken seriously in the lexicon of great midfield players. I don't think that's right, but I think the fact that Schweinsteiger was able to move into midfield and later into deep midfield and become one of the reference players there as well, shows that he was one of the very best. But with him, it's not just about what he was as a player, but what he meant to Bayern as an institution and in the dressing room. I would be very unsurprised to see him come into the fold in terms of management at some point later down the line. That would be completely natural, and I'm sure Bayern are very, very keen.
Get a job above up in the top brass and just stick the boot into Kovac.
Well, I think it. By the time Schweinsteiger comes in, I don't think Kovac will still be there.
More grist to the mill. What do you think about Kovac? He's a wanker.
But I think that the reason that's so notable is we talked about Pep Guardiola before and some of his bolder decisions at Bayern. I mean, I think we can look at it on a sporting level and say he did completely the right thing getting rid of Schweinsteiger when he did, and everything since has proved him right. But it was still a very traumatic and a very bold move because of what Schweinsteiger meant to the club, and people had a real difficulty letting go. Clearly the injuries were starting to mount up, and his influence on the pitch was really starting to wane, but it really hurt Bayern to get rid of him, and it was a really tough decision that really an outsider like Guardiola needed to make, and an outsider with that sort of power. Say if it was today, Kovac would never have the power to get rid of Schweinsteiger. It just wouldn't happen. So it was something that needed to be done, and Guardiola needed to do, but it was something that, you know, left its mark. He's greatly missed, and the day that he arrives back at the club, it will be a great cause for celebration.
James, any standout memories of Bastian?
World Cup final.
Yeah,
he was immense in Brazil. Also, just like, remember when he burst onto the scene in one summer? Was that Euro 2004? Was it 2004?
I think he made his debut for Germany in 2004. Yeah. So it could have been. Yeah.
Yeah, well, my recollection might be wrong here, but I remember obviously Germany were at that time not what they once were, and yet to be what they were to become, and yet he was seen as the shining light of that team.
I think he symbolised
what he evolved into over the years.
Did he not symbolise this kind of move into a new era for Germany after their kind of annus horribilis in 2001 ish?
Yeah, he was definitely. He was part of Clinzy's big kickoff. There's no doubt about that.
Over 100 international caps, captained the team at international level, 18 trophies or something like that, about 500 doubles in Germany, won the Champions League, won the World Cup, done it all, really.
Did arguably the best ice bucket challenge.
Did he really? God, that is a blast from the past.
Because he was, basically, it was him stood on the balcony of his flat, emptying a bucket, and then running down the stairs and being drenched by the bucket afterwards.
Creative. Wow. You wouldn't expect that at that point in his career, to be so creative.
No. That's more intensity than any United fans saw from him.
Yeah. Won the FA Cup with Man United as well, by the way.
Well, I mean, there's some great anecdotes in, Danny Taylor's piece about United and The Athletic about Schweini. Mm. Which, his time at United, which, you know... Let's not judge him on that.
I'd have thought on the ice bucket challenge at that point he would have been much more content to pass the bucket off simply to someone else and let them pour it over their own head. Let's get your games of the week, guys, very quickly if you don't mind.
We're bringing back games of the week.
We're bringing it back under huge, huge popular demand. I mean, just to the point where I could no longer ignore it.
Mm.
So we're bringing back games of the week. Andy, you are in Germany for yours, I believe. So please tell us what it is.
Battle of the Borussias. Saturday tea time and food recommendation to come.
Yeah, Dortmund against Gladbach, right?
It's Dortmund versus Borussia Mönchengladbach. And seeing that Dortmund in the last three games have drawn and given away the lead in all of those games, they clearly need some points. And if you look at this game on the whole, I mean, it's a game that's a really two big names in German football, but Dortmund in this fixture have had it all their own way in recent years. They've won the last five meetings between these two at Westfalen. But Gladbach arrive as league leaders, which is something completely unprecedented. And it was in the first couple of weeks of the season when they look as if Marco Rosa was struggling to get it together. But I think you look at their enduring counter-attacking style, you look at the fact that Alisson Plea, Marcus Thuram, even Breel and Bolo, who's getting it together, are all in really good
keeping
nick.
It Breel.
Yeah. Exactly. I think they could present a problem or two for Dortmund. And, you know, there have been increasing questions about Lucien Favre, and, you know, kind of hinted at it last week, didn't you, when Lars was talking about Dortmund and,
well, they've hit the buffers
and
a bit,
their
haven't
difficulties.
They?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, maybe the international break has been a time for Favre to reassess, because they've always been doubts over his ability to go from contender to finishing it off, certainly in a Bundesliga context. Mm. So this is where he has the chance to start putting that to bed, or do Dortmund reach a point where they decide they have to move on with this extremely talented squad?
I think that is, for me, the standout game at the weekend. I'm excited for it. James, you're going to have to go some to match up to that. What have you got?
Well, no, I mean, I'm looking forward to watching Lazio Atalanta at 2 o'clock on Saturday.
Yeah,
just because you get to see Atalanta play against a team in kind of Manchester City blue.
How their game?
Already won at the Olympico once this season.
Yeah, they have, and I must say, contrary to their performances in the Champions League,
they've been wicked, right?
This is Atalanta's best start in.
Is this your selection? Lazio Atalanta, okay, correct. Because normally you do about five, and then you say, "Oh no, but my
no." I think this is, probably the most balanced game of the weekend.
My real selection is Lyon versus Dijon. So you know,
yeah, we're all keen for that one.
But
very good.
Brilliant. Yeah. The issue that Atalanta have got is that Duván Zapata, who's made the most prolific start to a season of any Atalanta strike since Pippo Inzaghi back in the mid-90s. Mm. He suffered an injury with Colombia during the international break and will miss the City games, miss this game. So they're piling on to Luis Muriel. And Muriel has the best kind of minutes to goal ratio in the league at the moment, but that's because he's been a really good impact sub. And the rub with Muriel has always been, can you rely on him to stay healthy to play three games a week or just a game a week? So be curious. And Lazio as well, I think, have been unlucky so far this season. They
hit the post four times against Roma in the derby. Should have won that game.
That's careless, not unlucky.
They had a penalty. Well, I mean,
four times.
It's you know, life's a game of inches.
True.
You know, and
Al Pacino. Is it Al Pacino? Is it that or Ron Jeremy?
It's Al Pacino. and also in the game against Bologna before the international break, they had a penalty to win that game late, and Joaquin Correa, who I think is a really, really good player.
I love him.
Velcro touch. The only thing is, he gets into so many scoring positions, he just fluffs it all the time. Fluff that penalty, he fluffed chances against Inter. And, you know, I just, yeah, he's a really exciting player to watch. So much as I would say, go watch Malinovsky if you haven't seen him yet, go watch Papu Gomez Iličić, I'd say go watch Correa for this game as well. There's lots of talent on display.
And I would be very interested to see how Inter bounce back against Sassuolo away.
Yes.
Sassuolo, I was reading the other day that Sassuolo, I think, have got the highest ball percentage in the league.
Yeah.
They love having the ball. They're going to be at home. Mm. It'll be curious how Inter sort of tackle that, especially after their disappointment of losing their first game of the season, albeit a couple of weeks ago against Juventus.
But Inter don't need the ball to be effective, do they?
But it still makes it a fascinating encounter.
Sure.
I think so.
And Sassuolo, typically under Di Zerbi, have raised their game when they've played against the big teams. This is, you know, going to be quite an emotional occasion, I would suggest, because Giorgio Squinzi, the kind of patron of Sassuolo, he passed away before the last round of fixtures, which is why Sassuolo's game against Brescia was called off. And he was a massive Milan fan, and he used to love nothing more than when Sassuolo went and beat Inter. In fact, he would have a plaque put on the wall of his office every time they beat Inter, because they made such a regular habit of it.
Yeah.
When they didn't beat Inter, they lost 7-0 to Inter. So either way, this game has got great history as well, because it's the one that Icardi, who sadly is no longer at Inter, famously kind of said, shall we go outside, to those Inter ultras. Remember, this was the passage of his autobiography, which ended up
in big trouble,
almost with him leaving, well, the first time around, and it never happened.
Well, so then didn't they start saying, you'll never be our captain, and all this kind of stuff after that?
Yeah. So and he stayed on as captain until his wife basically decided to throw his teammates under the bus. So there's a lot to recommend that game as well.
This was a Stakhanov production.
People of the US, great news. The Formula One Circus is coming to Miami this weekend, and we've got everything you need to know on P1 with Matt and Tommy, the Formula One podcast from Stack. It doesn't matter if you're an F1 veteran or hardly watch a race. If you want a fun breakdown of the biggest stories from this weekend's race, we've got you covered. Join us for previews and reaction episodes from practice, qualifying and the race itself, plus our full driver rankings podcast early next week. You'll be armed with enough info to make you look like a bona fide expert when the race rolls back around next year, or at least when you see your friends next week. Search P1 with Matt and Tommy in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now.